The Guardian.
The Guardian is delighted to announce the launch of our new Global Development Professionals Network. It's completely free, and it's the place for global development professionals to share, discuss, and promote new ideas about the sector. With weekly newsletters, a first look at jobs, and live Q&As with global development experts. As a listener to this podcast, we're offering you the chance to win an iPad just for signing up to the network today. To find out more, head to guardian.co.uk/win the iPad.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratowski, and on this week's podcast, we're finding out more about SoundCloud, the social network where you can share your sounds with the world. We're also checking in with the conference network Lanyard.com about what they've got planned for 2013. We'll be discussing these stories and more over the next 30 minutes on Tech Weekly from The Guardian.
I'm Sarah Morgan, singer-songwriter, and I like to share my music on SoundCloud. I first heard about SoundCloud from a friend.
My name is Rob Eagle, and I'm a multimedia producer at University College London. We use SoundCloud to put up.
My name is Mark Wiedenbaum, and I live in San Francisco. Since 1996, I've run a website called Disquiet.com that exists at the intersection of sound, art, and technology. I use SoundCloud in a lot of different ways, but the primary.
SoundCloud, the YouTube for audio, is having a revamp, reorganizing content uploaded and shared by its 180 million users. We're joined by VC and blogger Fred Wilson, who either has a Midas touch or just great judgment, but he's an investor in Twitter, Tumblr, and Foursquare, and also an investor and avid user of SoundCloud. Fred, what makes SoundCloud so special?
Well, I think the thing that's special about SoundCloud is it's a service for all kinds of sounds, not just music, not just podcasts, not just remixes, or not just sound effects. It's everything. It's a hodgepodge. It's chaotic. It's messy. It's fun. It's creative, and it's cool. So it's like the web. It's got everything on it.
And SoundCloud has grown massively along with the general growth of audio and multimedia, but hasn't it been overshadowed by video a bit, which is easier to advertise around?
Well, I mean, the thing about video versus audio, Alex actually did this great keynote at Le Web last year on this topic, which I won't try to memorialize, but the thing that's different about audio and video is that video is a highly engaged experience. You have to watch it to enjoy it, whereas audio is something that you can multitask to. You can be in the gym on the treadmill, or you can be out on your bike, or you can be taking a walk through the park, or you can be on the train going to work, and you can be doing email or writing or any other thing and be consuming audio at the same time. So I think that if you look at the time spent listening metric on the internet versus almost any other metric, the numbers are way, way larger because it's a set it and forget it. I don't mean forget it in a bad way. It's just a cliche type of experience where you just turn it on and go. And so I think that while video is more engaging, I think audio is more persistent and ultimately has much, much higher levels of activity around it.
And a lot of the reorganization of the site is about kind of Zuckerbergian principles, if you like, of socializing the content. Does that have to be an essential part of the web these days?
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, making, particularly when you have something as messy as user-generated content or social media, and I use messy in the best way possible, anything that's truly open to anybody to publish anything anytime is going to be chaotic and messy. So the ideas around a news feed and the following and friending functions and the discovery elements that Facebook and Twitter and Tumblr and others have popularized absolutely needs to be part of the SoundCloud experience.
And who is SoundCloud competing with? Is this competing with, or if not taking eyeballs from traditional music and media, maybe ear holes, or is this a totally new sector, a new kind of audio?
Well, everything on the web competes with everything on the web. You make a decision to use SoundCloud in lieu of using iTunes or Spotify or Pandora, which is popular here in the States. So at some level, you know, everything is competitive with everything. But I think SoundCloud is really charting a new course in many ways. It's a two-way medium. People post sounds into SoundCloud and people consume sounds out of SoundCloud. unlike most of the things in the music industry, which are truly one-way experiences. That it's like you're listening to a machine. So I think it's unique and different in many important ways.
Mobile must already be a really significant part of what SoundCloud offers to people, given that you can listen to audio while you're doing any number of other things. How is that part of its future?
I think it is its future. I don't mean to dismiss the release that the company is doing around Next and the new web interface, which is fantastic, but I think if you were to, go into a time machine and go 5 or 10 years forward, you would see the vast amount of engagement, 70, 80, 90% of the engagement of a service like SoundCloud would be on a mobile device. So I think it's the future of the company.
Fred Wilson, thank you very much. You can follow Fred Wilson on SoundCloud. It's soundcloud.com/Fred Wilson. And there'll also be more from guardian.co.uk/technology.
I'm joined in the studio now by Charles Arthur, The Guardian's technology editor. Charles, welcome to the studio.
Hi.
So this week, briefly, it was the 20th anniversary of the first text message.
Mm.
What was the first thing you sent via SMS? Do you remember?
The first thing I sent? Wow. I don't remember, actually. It wasn't such an incredible moment. I can't even remember who it would have been to.
But actually, Charles, does that mean that it wasn't such a significant thing in your world? It has text messaging, made a huge impact on how we use these technologies?
Well, I mean, I got my first mobile phone in 1995, so this is a fair while back. So at that time, the text message was only 3 years old. It was a comparatively new technology. The thing that really made the text message take off, and I actually got an email to this effect from Richard Jarvis, who was the guy who sent the first one, was the advent of pay-as-you-go phones, which happened a few years after that. And the discovery that texts were much cheaper to send than to make a phone call, that you could, in effect, get as much information over as you would get in a three-minute phone call in a single text, that's what made it really take off. And that discovery and the fact that all sorts of services started to be incorporated into text, so you'd start getting news alerts, you'd start getting stock alerts, you'd start getting things like, what's happening in the Big Brother house. In places like Finland, you get text telling you when the bus was coming, because you don't want to be hanging around in Finland during the winter for too long waiting for the bus. All these things, have made text just explode as a medium for communicating.
But now, you wrote an article this week to the effect that you questioned whether its golden era is over, that it's actually on the wane. Why do you think that?
Well, the number of texts sent seems to have peaked in a number of Western countries. So the Netherlands, Finland, Spain, they've all seen an actual drop in the number of texts sent. And that's not for any fall in the ownership of phones. What's happening is that people are using over-the-top services, as they're called, things like WhatsApp and BlackBerry Messenger, and now Apple's come into it with things like iMessage. These all use the data service rather than using the voice channel that SMS does. And because of that, because data services are becoming sort of bundled in with phone plans, it means that actually when it comes to measuring a text message, you're not sending a text, you're sending a little piece of data. And that's what BBM had for so long to itself. The advent of WhatsApp, which only started up in 2009, now is doing 10 billion messages a day. This all speaks to the size of the network. It's 250 million people using WhatsApp.
So in fact, it's not as if text messaging is going the way of the dodo. It's just simply shifting to a different service where you don't have to pay for every time you send a message.
It's moving to a different form. Yeah, you could say. I mean, the thing about text messaging is that it does work across all phones. Any phone that can do voice can do text, because that's in effect how SMS is sent. Whereas for WhatsApp, you both got to be on WhatsApp. For iMessage, you both got to be on iMessage. BBM, both got to be on BBM. And that for the moment, remains the problem that they have. So the M-Pesa system, which is widely used in Africa and to a lesser extent in India, for sending money, you know, that works by text. And that's the great power that text has, which is that it's a baseline. It's your lowest common denominator, which will function across everything. Whereas the OTT services, the data services, you know, they require a bit more. You need a phone that can run an app, and you have to have a bit more, you know, functionality, and you both got to be on it.
Now, that's an interesting thing you said there. We haven't talked much about M-Pesa yet. It's a phenomenon that started in Africa, as you suggested, to exchange money. Can you tell me a little bit more about that and how this shift into, sort of smartphones or feature phones, high-end feature phones, might affect that if people then in those territories start moving over to these data packages as opposed to the text services that are endemic in those countries?
Well, M-Pesa is a sort of method of sending promissory notes for people who don't have bank accounts. So it's a sort of way of, it's rather like a, you know, there's a very old system for sending money between countries when you want to move large amounts of money from one person to another, but you don't actually want to transfer the money. What you do is you have two people in the countries and you have a carry who goes between who has a note, which simply says, give this guy, you know, a large amount of money. M-Pesa works on a much smaller scale, but it's sort of what you do with money in the same way. The question becomes one of, will this transfer over to smartphones? Will you have sort of banking apps? You know, there's a big split between Africa, in effect, where you have lots of people who do not have bank accounts, but, you know, do have need to exchange money, and Western countries where you have lots of people who have bank accounts, where it's highly regulated, where, you know, you're not really going to be swapping money around in the same way. And it's interesting that efforts to do sort of money by text message or money by phone really haven't succeeded in the West to anything like the extent that they have in Africa.
Also in the news this week, the Syrian civil war took a technological turn when access to the internet was shut off by the government. Charles, what do we know about this situation in Syria?
The Syrian telecommunications company, which is in effect controlled by the Syrian government, the Syrian regime led by President Assad, cut off all access to the outside world via the internet, via phones, sometime during Thursday and Friday of last week. And that seems to have been pretty much complete. It's really been a big block. So the only way to get messages in or out would be by satellite phones. And they can do that because they can, you know, they have a chokehold. They can, you know, control what sort of access there is. There aren't private lines in the same sort of way. And there are very few ways in and out of Syria in terms of telecoms.
But how is this different? How is this possible when, for example, in Egypt in 2011, it wasn't possible to do this? There were still ways that people were able to get out of the country, whether they were rogue networks that were set up or mobile phones.
Well, Syria is a much smaller country, and the surroundings are slightly different. You know, the countries on the borders are rather different. So, you know, I haven't heard anything about other signals getting through. As I say, you know, sort of things like sat phones and stuff will still work. But it cuts off a huge proportion of the connectivity that people would otherwise have.
Is there an intranet? Are people able to communicate within the country, or is it completely, or is it something that's, you know, full stop, that's it, there is no communication?
As far as we can tell, there's still communication inside Syria, but it's just that the lines to the outside world, which are, yeah, because it's all computers, all the exchanges are just computers. You know, basically you can just block what they do, and that's really the key element here, which is that you know, you just block the incoming, outgoing calls.
So Syria ultimately has been more successful in this regard than Egypt has been. Is it a proof
it's
of concept to, for the rest
easy,
of for the
it's
for other
do
regimes?
Much easier to do it with a small country than a big one. Egypt's a really big country. Syria's a really small country by comparison.
Do you imagine that we'll be seeing more of this in the future as governments are trying to coerce people, or rather regulate people into towing the line?
I mean, you know, this is an exceptional case. Egypt was an exceptional case. You know, wherever there's been, you know, uprisings in the Middle East, we've seen sort of mild manifestations of this. And you know, it's an extreme step, because it affects your economy in a colossal way. You know, if you can't get phone calls or internet in or out, then actually that means your international trade just goes straight to zero almost. And without international trade, you know, for just simple things like oil and so on, then that's a big problem.
As the UN has declared information access a human right, is there any global body that can turn to Assad's government and say, you have to do this, otherwise you're obstructing people's civil liberties?
Well, the International Telecoms Union pointed out that Syria was a signatory to the declaration, which says that they will provide these sorts of communications rights. But given the fact that the Assad regime is bombing its own citizens, I don't think they're going to be too worried about the ITU telling it they have to turn the phones on.
Well, we shall keep our eyes on this story as it unfolds. Finally this week, Charles, there's an update on the John McAfee situation. John McAfee being the man who originally created the McAfee antivirus software, sold it and then disappeared somewhere and has now been on the run, accused allegedly of murder. What's the latest on this story?
So McAfee lived in Belize, has been accused of the murder of his neighbour, has gone on the run because he says he didn't do it, but he says the Belize police have a grudge against him and are going to make a wrongful arrest. No one has known quite where he is, though they've sort of wondered if he might be in the jungles of Belize or something. Vice magazine caught up with him and they published a photo of him. And the interesting thing was that this photo having been published, someone decided to have a look at the EXIF data that goes with it, which gives you things like, you know, when was the photo taken, what sort of exposure was it. But sometimes it also has geotags. And this one did. And that showed that he was actually in Guatemala. And this having been revealed, suddenly he updated his blog and said, I openly apologize to Vice magazine for manipulating their recently published photo. I've been ferociously put in my place by Mr. Rucker, that's the photographer, the guy who took the photo, for interfering with the objectivity of their reporting. I, for my own safety, manipulated the EXIF data on the image taken from my cell phone and created a fake emergency so the urgency of movement led, as I knew it would, to the hasty posting on their website. So what he's trying to say is, I'm not really in Guatemala, where it says I am with a big arrow on Google Maps. I faked it. I think you can sort of take this as possibly true, possibly not true.
I'd be really, really impressed. I mean, it demonstrates the level of his paranoia.
Yeah, it's got to be said that you don't have to be paranoid to believe that they're out to get you. But actually, you know, it's quite possible that A, they're out to get him, and B, quite possibly he is paranoid. But, you know, EXIF data, the fact that it was only after this that he came up with this posting sort of makes you think, I'd start looking around where that big arrow is pointing in Guatemala even so.
How easy is it to manipulate EXIF data?
You can do it. You need a sort of EXIF editor, which is probably pretty easy to come by. I don't know how easy it would be to get one on a smartphone. What's not clear is the route by which the photo got from his smartphone onto this guy's device and, you know, then up to the website. So I'd sort of give it only 50-50 that this data is faked, but, you know, he's clearly trying to put people off the scent on it.
And how on earth did the Vice journalist find him?
This has all sort of opened a question at me. But McAfee has been phoning journalists up and sort of trying to put his side of the story. And, he's been, one poor guy at Wired has been getting calls pretty much every hour or so, which...
I can imagine it's like The Killing with Sarah Lund in the background saying, wait, make sure he stays on the line.
Yeah, but we're sort of rainforests.
Indeed. Anyway, there's more on all of these stories at guardian.co.uk/technology. Our digital correspondent, Jemima Kish, has been hard at work this week talking to big-time tech VCs like Fred Wilson, but also snooping around London's tech city to sound out one of the area's most interesting startups. Lanyard.com is an innovative events and conference communication service that taps into the power of Twitter and professional networks. For Tech Weekly, Jemima found out more.
I'm with Simon Willison. He's co-founder and CEO of Lanyard, which is a startup that helps you discover, organise and socialise around professional events. Simon, can you just give us the skinny on Lanyard? When did you start and explain a bit more about what you do?
Sure. So we have a slightly unconventional origin story. We're actually a husband and wife co-founding team, and we started the site by accident on our honeymoon as a sort of side project. We found ourselves stuck in Morocco with food poisoning and unable to keep on traveling. So we rented an apartment for 2 weeks, cooked for ourselves in the kitchen and worked on this project we'd been talking about. And it quickly sort of took off and spiraled out of control. We ended up fixing it from the road in Morocco and Egypt, and then applying for Y Combinator, which is a startup school out in the San Francisco. And so we moved back to London, we raised money from investors, we hired a team to help us out, and we've had this sort of whirlwind ride through the London startup scene over the past 12 months.
So how many of you are there now?
So we're six people now. We've got the two co-founders, we've hired a fantastic technical team, some of them from other parts of the startup ecosystem. And we're working in an office just off Old Street.
How much money have you raised so far?
So we raised a $1.4 million seed round from investors last year. That was primarily European investors, actually. We raised from Index Ventures Seed and ProFounders Capital. We have a number of American angel investors involved as well.
Primarily, when people use your site, they use Twitter to log in. Tell us a bit more about that.
So our original idea was to look at the intersection of people who use Twitter and people who go to conferences. And we found that there's actually this enormous overlap between the two. There were loads of people using the conference hashtag, talking about conferences, speakers were including their Twitter name in their slides. You know, there was a whole ecosystem around that. And that did us very well for starting the service and bootstrapping it. But the big thing we're doing on Monday is shipping the ability for people to start signing in with LinkedIn as well. So the idea with Twitter is you sign in with Twitter, we look at the people you follow, and we show you events that those people are speaking at or are planning to go to, which for a lot of industries gives people really good recommendations. You can follow a sort of high-profile speaker in your field without them necessarily following you back. What we're doing now is we're letting people use LinkedIn for that as well. So if you have a professional network on LinkedIn, we can recommend events based on the industries you're involved with and also the people you're connected with and the events that they're involved with.
It's quite a different user base, though, LinkedIn, isn't it? I mean, Twitter's very sociable. It's got, you know, pictures of cats, as we know. LinkedIn, isn't that a bit more, you know, people posting their CVs and sharing them and trying to get their friends to put testimonials on them? How's this going to work and change your user base?
So this was definitely the case in the past, that LinkedIn was the sort of static place where you maintain your CV and Twitter was where you went for the social stuff. But actually, in the past few months, LinkedIn's own activity stream stuff has really been picking up. It's become a place for professionals to sort of share links around things that they're working on, things that they're interested in.
And this is since Twitter posts were no longer allowed to be published on LinkedIn.
That's right. It was quite surprising, actually. A few months ago, LinkedIn were mainly republishing tweets into the LinkedIn network, which made it not that interesting because the stuff you saw on LinkedIn, you'd already seen on Twitter. But once they stopped doing that, suddenly there was a whole load of activity exclusive to LinkedIn, which was much more focused on sort of professional sharing and industry-specific news. So actually, it's become a much more interesting place for people to visit on a daily basis as opposed to a few months ago.
So events listings on LinkedIn. Tell us how this is going to work for Lanyard.
So LinkedIn are closing down their own event service on the 26th, which was a service that let people say which events they were going to and see what their connections were going to, very much like the way Lanyard works. LinkedIn have chosen to sort of refocus their engineering efforts on the more sharing and activity stream related stuff. And this gives us an opportunity to sort of step in and fill that hole, make sure that LinkedIn users have somewhere where they can promote the events they're involved in, they can find out what's going on within their LinkedIn network. We kind of feel that LinkedIn is the place online where you keep your professional CV, and Lanyard is the place where you keep your professional event portfolio, especially if you're a speaker that's giving talks around, at conferences around the world. So we think the two things complement each other really nicely.
What does this mean for user numbers then? Does it mean that the existing users just get an extra string on their bow that they get to link in with their LinkedIn profile? Or does it mean that you're trying to reach more US users or more rich users?
So we've actually had some level of LinkedIn functionality for quite a while. We've had a whole bunch of our existing users attach their LinkedIn accounts. But really with this, while we're looking to enhance the experience for existing users, we're particularly interested in breaking into new industries. So industries like technology and journalism and things that people are using Twitter, and that works really well. But there are a whole bunch of other industries and potentially more lucrative industries in terms of the conference market that aren't really adopting Twitter in the same numbers. So our hope is that we can appeal to those industries much more easily with our LinkedIn integration.
But you can't talk about specific user numbers for your audience?
No, we don't talk about user numbers.
Okay. It'd be interesting as well to know how successful it's been being part of Tech City. What's been your experience there?
So we're based just off Old Street Roundabout. So I guess we're within the Tech City catchment area. And I think Tech City are kind of aware that they're not really making that environment happen so much as they're promoting it and sort of helping get the message out that this is happening. In terms of the environment itself, it's absolutely amazing. You know, there are well over 1,000 actual proper startups around our area, companies that have hired people, they've launched products, they're making money, they've got investors. And that's a huge difference from a few years ago, where it was very rare to find somebody who wasn't just sort of tinkering on something in their spare time with dreams of making it larger. And that's really exciting. And it's very important for us as first-time startup founders to have other startups nearby, because there are always things that you just don't know how to do. And there'll be another startup in the office next door who did it a few months ago, and they can tell you, look, this is how we did it. This is what you need to do next.
Is it quite telling, though, that to get Lanyard off the ground, you had to go to an American startup incubator in the form of Y Combinator?
Well, When we went to Y Combinator, we weren't actually based in England. We were traveling through Egypt at the time, and we'd given up our flats back home. So really, we could have gone with an incubator anywhere. But I think it's not so much the American incubator; it's Y Combinator in particular, which has really pioneered the model of, well, they don't like to call themselves an incubator, but the model that they have works incredibly well, and they're very, very good at what they do. So certainly, going through Y Combinator gave us extremely good access to meetings with investors afterwards.
What's next for Lanyard then, Simon? You're obviously growing quite rapidly, and there is a lot of interest and a lot of use among people in the tech community.
The big thing for us next is it's expanding out into new industries. It's sort of breaking away, jumping the chasm from the early adopters to people who aren't necessarily constantly seeking out new things to try out. We also want to start focusing more on our commercial offerings to help conferences put on better events.
Fantastic. Simon, thank you very much for your time, and we'll be following Lanyard and as many of the other London startups as we can possibly muster on Tech Weekly.
That's it for this week on Tech Weekly. Thanks to Jemima Kish and to Charles Arthur. I'm Alex Kratosky, and the producer was Jason Phipps. We'll be back next Tuesday.
Don't forget to sign up for free to The Guardian's Global Development Professionals Network, and you could be in with the chance of winning an iPad. Find out more now at guardian.co.uk/win the iPad.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.